October 10th, and this is the General One podcast. This is episode 3, which is called Numbers, Numbers, Numbers. So at this point, you should have been making your outlines, and hopefully you've got all 5 outlines complete, and you've kind of gone through this assessment of where you are, and you've sort of flagged things that you've needed to learn more about, and you're beginning to think of things to work on, and you're working away at some problems. And hopefully by now, after 2 weeks, the sitting down for half an hour each day has become habit, and it's really kind of a part of your daily routine, and not something that you think about. And hopefully you're feeling like you're making slow but steady progress towards General One, and you're not stressing about it too much and are able to concentrate on your classes and the exciting research that you're just now starting to do. Today we're going to talk about numbers. If you've looked at the General One exam, it's probably become clear to you that we are going to ask you to evaluate numerical quantities and give answers in electron volts or meters or times. And many people feel that this is really sort of a waste. Frequently students say, well, I'm going to study theory, so I don't really need to know these numbers the way an experimentalist would. Or people say, well, numbers aren't really very important because you can always look them up, and I'll have a little wallet card so that I can look up the mass of the electron anytime I need it. Well, that's fine, and those things are true. But remember, you're training to be a physicist, and one of the things a physicist does, as we've discussed before, like anyone in a creative profession, is to have ideas and then be able to quickly assess those ideas and discard the ones that are maybe not so good because they require an accelerator with a gigawatt output or a scanning electron microscope resolution of 2 Fermis or things like that. So it's important to be able to put numbers in quickly and evaluate them at least the order of magnitude level, but preferably kind of the one significant digit level. We'll come back to this later on when we talk about making temperature scales and energy scales. It's all part of, you know, building a sense of what physics is and being able to assess the thoughts you have. Now, of course, we work in the metric system, so you won't have to memorize conversions to inches or pounds or things like that. And we'll need to know both SI and CGS units for electromagnetic relations. And I'll talk more about going from one to the other in a later podcast. But you do need to use both CGS because the rendering of Maxwell's equations is much simpler in CGS. It's just easier to work in CGS because the electric and magnetic field have the same base units. But the problem with CGS is that, for example, the volts are expressed in stat volts, is the unit of potential. And if you go into economy hardware and ask the guy for a 0.03 stat volt battery, you know, he's just going to slap you. And, you know, that's probably right. You should ask for a 9-volt battery. So you'll need to be able to go back and forth. And this isn't very hard. I think you can really do it just by remembering that the electron charge is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, or 4.8 times 10 to the minus 10 electrostatic units. But we'll come back to that later on. The good news about numerical evaluation is that it's not very hard, and you don't have to go out and memorize a whole bunch of constants. It makes much more sense to memorize combinations of constants, and there's probably one or two that you don't already know. So let's kind of go through what you should know. velocity of light, 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. You should know that. You probably already do. Mole is 6 times 10 to the 23 particles in a mole. Now, K Boltzmann T at room temperature is 1/40th of an electron volt. Room temperature is 300 Kelvin. So immediately you have K Boltzmann T, because K Boltzmann then is just 1 electron volt per 12,000 degrees K. So that's an example of why it makes much more sense to remember K Boltzmann T is 1/40th when T is equal to 300. A very, very useful quantity to remember is H bar C, which is 197 MeV Fermi, or you can really round it to 200 MeV Fermi, or 0.2 GeV Fermi, or if you're an atomic physicist, I think it's 2 times 10 to the minus 5 electron volt centimeters. This allows you to immediately convert wavelengths to energies, or energies to time, because you can convert an energy to a length just by dividing H bar C by the energy. That gives you a length, and then you divide by C, which you already know. So you can convert energies to times and lengths. Now, one thing that frequently trips people up is having to evaluate the electron charge and getting messed up in units. There's a very easy way to do this. Remember that the thing you usually want is E squared. For example, if you're asked to find the force between two particles some distance apart, that's going to be E squared over R squared. What you want to do is make use of the fact that the fine structure constant alpha is 1 over 137, and that's equal to E squared over H bar C. So E squared is equal to H bar C divided by 137, and then you divide by the length squared to get the force in the appropriate units. Now, to do that problem, you're going to have to convert electron volts to joules. This isn't hard, because you certainly already know that a mole of protons, which are hydrogen atoms, a mole of hydrogen weighs a gram. So a gram is 10 to the minus 3 kilograms multiplied by C squared, which is 9 times 10 to the 16th meter second squared, and that's equal to 6 times 10 to the 23 times 10 to the 9 electron volts, which is a proton mass in electron volts. Proton weighs about a GeV. And so right there you have a way of calculating from electron volts to either joules, if you leave in the C squared, or kilograms if you divide through by C squared. It's very simple, and you should practice it a few times just to make sure you know how to do it. Some other constants you should remember: the density of the Earth is about 5 grams per cubic centimeter. The radius of the Earth is 6.4 million meters, or 6,400 kilometers. You should know the Earth-Sun distance, which is, I believe, 150,000 kilometers, 158 million kilometers. The Moon is 25,000 miles away. I remember that because I remember Apollo. I don't know what it is in meters, but you can, of course, convert. The galaxy is about 15 kiloparsecs across. It's maybe 800 parsecs thick, and the Earth is 8.5 kiloparsecs out. We'll go through different distances you should know. But one reason I mentioned the density and radius of the Earth is that I can never remember what big G, the Newton's constant, is. I remember it's 6.6 times 10 to the minus 11, but then I can never remember what the units are. Fortunately, there's a simple way to go through this. Remember that the acceleration due to gravity at the surface of the Earth is 10 meters second squared, and that's equal to big G times the mass of the Earth divided by the radius of the Earth squared. So you can just substitute it in for the mass of the Earth, which is 4/3 pi times the radius of the Earth cubed times the density. So put that in and solve for big G. What you find is that big G has units of energy times length divided by mass squared, and you should remember this because potential energy in a gravitational field is big G times M1 times M2 divided by R. So the units of G have to be energy times length divided by mass squared. And another thing you want to become proficient at is going through and doing a dimensional analysis to make sure that your units are right. That's a very quick way of catching errors. So here's a little exercise in putting together units. The Planck length is a combination of gravitational units and quantum mechanical units. Gravity is, of course, completely characterized by capital G. That's the only fundamental constant that has anything to do with gravity. And quantum mechanics is expressed in Fermi's constant, which we never remember. Planck's constant, which we never remember. We remember h-bar c. So find the Planck length by finding the combination of big G, h-bar, and c that give you a length. Do this without looking any of them up. Once you found the Planck length, convert that to the Planck energy, the Planck mass, and the Planck time in the way we've just described. So you can just do that now. It should take you, maybe 15 minutes the first time you do it. And you should sort of practice doing these things over and over. Just not hundreds of times, but maybe 10 times so that you know how to perform these manipulations quickly. Wanted to mention a couple of scientific results that are out. One is the observation of the Grison-Zazeppin-Kuzman cutoff, which is a cutoff in cosmic rays at very, very high energies. We'll actually calculate this in a future podcast on relativity, but this observation has been made by the Hi-Res collaboration, and they've reported it in Astro PH 0609403 as an observation of this cutoff. This cutoff is caused by protons hitting microwave background photons and basically emitting a pion, and limits the highest energy of cosmic rays that you can observe. Cosmic rays go with an energy spectrum of e to the minus 2.7 all the way up until this cutoff. And there was a while when an experiment in Japan, Akino, claimed to observe events above the cutoff, and this triggered a huge amount of experimental activity, culminating in the Pierre-Auger experiment. Well, it looks like Pierre Auger got scooped by Hi-Res, which is a little experiment in the Dugway proving ground, and hopefully brings to an end to this question of whether or not there is a cutoff. The new physics explanations for the cutoff I always found rather uninteresting, and in fact, I found the whole field rather tedious. So maybe this is now over with. There is another interesting paper in Science titled Silk-Like Secretion from Tarantula Feet. These guys found that tarantulas, which are rather large spiders, as you may know, actually secrete the same material as from web, as they make their webs from the bottoms of their feet, and this allows them to stick to things a little bit better, which is good if you're a tarantula, because tarantulas don't really have a very strong exoskeleton, and tarantulas are quite large. So if you're large and you don't have a good exoskeleton, you don't want to be falling too often, and you want to be able to stick to things. And so apparently nobody ever noticed that they squirt this stuff out of their feet so that they can stick to walls and climb a little bit more effectively. And that's in the most recent edition of Nature, along with quite a number of interesting papers on Bose-Einstein condensation, including the first indication that Bose-Einstein condensates on a microchip are possible. So here is a practice problem for General 1. This is actually kind of a complex of problems in both mechanics and classical mechanics. Mechanics and quantum mechanics. And it's one of those problems that's pretty rich. You can sort of set it up and then do a lot of different things with it. So an actual General 1 problem would only be sort of one piece of what I'm about to describe. But go ahead and work through all of it. It'll be good practice. So think about a torus. And the torus is oriented in such a way that the symmetry axis of the torus is along the z-axis. And there's a particle of some mass confined to the surface of the torus. And there's a gravitational field pointing along the z-axis. So write the Lagrangian for the system and find the cyclic coordinates and describe the motion in a couple of sentences, the different classes of motion that there can be. Once you've done that, find the equilibrium point of the particle, a point where the particle can be at rest. And then determine the frequency of small oscillation around that equilibrium point. This is tricky a little bit because remember that there's a cyclic coordinate involved and that can have an impact. Once you've done all that, forget about the magnetic field and treat the system quantum mechanically and find the eigenwave functions for the particle on the torus and the eigenenergies and classify the energies according to angular momentum, taking the quantization axis along the z-axis. Once you've done that, make a level diagram, and the level diagram has the different energy levels going up and the different angular momenta going across. Now there's a little bit of a subtlety, because the next part is to work out the degeneracies at each level. There are two parameters that describe the torus, and of course those enter into the energy and angular momentum, and for specific values of those two parameters, of course the degeneracies can be very different. So consider that when you work out the degeneracy and sort of think through it. Now, having done all of that, you can apply a very, very weak magnetic field and say the electron, the particle is an electron. So that, I'm sorry, there's a very weak electric field and say the particle is an electron. And work out the perturbation to the lowest couple of energy levels due to the electron using perturbation theory. Actually, it's kind of interesting. It's probably too hard, but think about what happens if there is a magnetic field along the z-axis in both the classical and quantum mechanical case. For the classical case, once you've done everything that I've described, you can say, all right, the torus is oriented with the symmetry axis along x, so the gravitational field points across the torus. Go ahead, find the cyclic coordinates again, and find the amplitude of small oscillations around the equilibrium point. So as I mentioned, that all of that is much, much more than any general one problem. But you could put, you know, two or three of those calculations together as a general one problem. And that's a nice, simple system that's fairly rich. So probably well worth working through. That is the end of today's General One podcast. As usual, I'd like to thank all the people who've helped and kind of inspired and told me this was a good thing to do. Bonna Newman from REFS, and Sheila Marston and her husband John, and Sean Thompson. And I'm always happy to hear from you. Remember, my email is fisherp@mit.edu, and the next podcast will be out next Monday. And until then, have a good time studying, and enjoy your next week here in Cambridge at MIT. Good night.